content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, Elon Musk moves against the Russians in Ukraine. The story written by Simon Schuster. On a frigid day late last month, a Russian attack drone slipped through Ukraine's air defense systems and glided into Kyiv's government district, heading in the direction of President Volodymyr Zelensky's office. The drone flew so low that officials inside the Cabinet of Ministers building could see it passing beneath them from their windows on the seventh floor. A bunch of people saw it and were running around like, "What the heck was that?" one government official recalled. The drone, later identified as a Russian BM-35, caused minor damage when it crashed into a nearby building, injuring no one, the official said, on the condition of anonymity. But the incident, which has not been previously reported, set in motion a chain of events that would allow Ukraine to seize the momentum at the front with the help of an unlikely ally, Elon Musk. Since the start of the Russian invasion 4 years ago, Musk has played an outsized role in determining the course of the war. His high-speed internet service, Starlink, uses portable satellite dishes to create a Wi-Fi connection anywhere in the world, and it has allowed both the Russian and Ukrainian militaries to stay online in the war zone, coordinate troop movements, and navigate drones. No other system can match the reach and stability of Starlink, which runs on the world's largest constellation of satellites. Musk has occasionally used that system in ways that have helped one side of the war or the other. In the fall of 2022, Musk intervened to limit the use of Starlink in Ukraine in a way that senior officers in Kyiv perceived as a service to Russian President Vladimir Putin. He argued he only wanted to avoid an escalation that would provoke the Kremlin to use nuclear weapons. This time, his actions worked in Ukraine's favor, helping its troops break through Russia's defensive lines in one small but significant section of the front. The reasoning behind Musk's recent decision to limit Russian access to his technology remains unclear, and he did not respond to numerous requests for comment. The move to back Ukraine seems out of character for Musk, who has tended to follow his ally Donald Trump in advocating for a swift end to the war, even if it forces Ukraine to grant painful concessions to the Russians. Whatever caused Musk's apparent change of heart, the authorities in Kyiv are grateful for it. Soon after the drone incursion into central Kyiv last month, Ukrainian officials appealed directly to Musk for help. The newly appointed Minister of Defense, Mykhailo Fedorov, presented Musk with evidence of Russian forces using Starlink to operate their long-range drones, including the one that breached Ukraine's most sensitive airspace. Fedorov wrote on X, which Musk also owns, on January 29th, "Western technologies must continue to support the democratic world and protect civilians, not to be used for terror and the destruction of peaceful cities." In a series of talks with Musk and his team, the Ukrainians offered a plan to block the Russians from using Starlink. According to several government and military sources familiar with the plan's implementation, its first phase took effect in the last days of January, severely curtailing the ability of both warring sides to use Starlink for their attack drones. SpaceX, the company that operates the Starlink network, then developed a whitelist of Ukrainian users and shut off access for the Russians. The whitelist was created software-wise in, like, one day, a person familiar with the implementation of the plan told me. The SpaceX team behind it received clear instructions from its bosses. No limits. Take off the gloves. Use Starlink for anything to help Ukraine. Even inside the company, there was confusion as to what exactly motivated Musk. But there was a political decision from Elon, for sure, the person said. By the first days of this month, Russian forces began to suffer severe problems with their battlefield communications. Starlink is our Achilles heel, Alexander Kotz, one of Moscow's most experienced war correspondents, who spends much of his time embedded with Russian troops in Ukraine, said. Unfortunately, we will not get a proper replacement for this system anytime soon, he told the host of a Russian podcast. I can't even imagine, in principle, how we can catch up with Musk's creation. Without the ability to operate drones or communicate through Starlink, the Russians have struggled to hold their defensive lines, and the Ukrainians have advanced. In the first 3 weeks of February, they seized more than 300 square kilometers of land from the Russians, Zelensky said in an interview with the French news agency AFP. Without a doubt, our forces are exploiting the problems that the Russians are having with Starlink, he said. A few days later, the commander of Ukraine's armed forces, General Oleksandr Spryskyi, said in a social media post that the Ukrainians had liberated 8 villages and more than 400 square kilometers during the past month, a rate of advance that Ukraine has not achieved in well over a year of grinding attritional combat. This turn of fortune will not be enough to defeat the Russians, who still possess a much larger army with a far superior arsenal of weapons, including nuclear missiles. But any sign of Russian weakness on the battlefield can help strengthen Ukraine's position at the negotiating table, Zelensky told me earlier this month during an interview in his office in Kyiv. Ukraine is not losing, he said. We have it rough. But to say that in these last 6 months they are winning somehow? No. The assistance from Musk has helped Zelensky drive home this argument, both to his own people and to the Russians. It has also reminded Ukraine's allies in Europe of the power that Musk wields over the course of this war. Through his satellite network, he can shift the balance in one direction or the other, all from the comfort of the SpaceX headquarters in Boca Chica, Texas. Do we want to be dependent on Elon Musk? No. Armin Papinger, head of Germany's biggest defense company, Rheinmetall, which plans to build an alternative to Starlink for the German military, told me in an interview last week. If he closes his satellites, if he closes communications, we have a problem, Papinger said. This time around, Musk assisted Ukraine and its allies in the war. But their dependence on his good graces still worries the Europeans. We need to be independent from Musk, Papinger said. That is a strategic necessity. Ukraine and its allies first realized the depth of their dependence on Starlink in the fall of 2022 when Musk used a system to stop a Ukrainian attack against the Russians. That September, Ukraine's main intelligence service, the SBU, developed a plan to sink Russian warships stationed in Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula, that Russia seized from Ukraine in 2014. Working in concert with the U.S. military, the SBU planned to use a flotilla of naval drones to sneak into the port of Sevastopol, the home of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. The operation involved a small group of Ukrainian-made drone boats, each one packed with more than 100 kilograms of C4 explosives and remotely controlled with a Starlink terminal. Ivan Lukashevich, the SBU general who led the mission, told me that he went to great lengths to make sure that the Starlink units would work around the shores of Crimea. As part of the preparations, two undercover SBU agents boarded a commercial vessel traveling from Constanta, Romania, past the shores of Crimea and into the port of Poti, Georgia. They had a Starlink with them, and they were checking if it worked along that route. Lukashevich, who goes by the call sign Hunter, said, "It worked perfectly." From the agency's command post, five stories beneath a high-rise in Kyiv, the general and several of his comrades, including Fedorov, monitored the launch of the naval drones on a bank of screens. The vessels traveled for about 7 hours until they came within about 40 nautical miles of their target. But as the boat at the front of the flotilla rounded the western tip of Crimea, its satellite link to the command center cut off, Lukashevich said. The entire operation hinged on these communications, Lukashevich said. At first I thought it may be a problem with the first boat, so we sent two more of them to the same spot, and as soon as they crossed a certain line, they also went dark. That's when we understood they had been turned off. Fedorov, who was then serving as the minister in charge of Ukraine's drone program, began calling his contacts at SpaceX to find the source of the breakdown. But he could not get any clear answers. After months of planning, the SBU was forced to abort the mission and bring its drones back to shore. Lukashevich was furious. Musk decided to do a bit of work for Putin, the general said. He saved the Russian fleet. Musk later released a statement to clarify his reasoning. He confirmed that he had received an emergency request from the government in Kyiv to activate Starlink all the way to Sevastopol, and he said he refused to grant it. If I had agreed to their request, then SpaceX would be explicitly complicit in a major act of war and conflict escalation, Musk wrote. Before that intervention, the Ukrainians had seen Musk as a steadfast partner in the war. He had provided them with hundreds of Starlink terminals free of charge at the start of the invasion, joining an initial chorus of support for Ukraine in Silicon Valley, where tech billionaires give generous donations to help push back the Russian assault. But the mood among Musk and his associates changed as Russia intensified its threats to use nuclear weapons against Ukraine and its Western allies. Musk wanted nothing to do with that kind of escalation. How am I in this war? He asked his biographer Walter Isaacson in 2022. Starlink was not meant to be involved in wars. It was so people can watch Netflix and chill and get online for school and do good, peaceful things, not drone strikes. Musk soon demanded payment from the Pentagon for the Starlink services provided to Ukraine's armed forces, and he grew vocal in calling for an end to the war. The Ukrainians responded by trying to break their dependence on Starlink, and Lukashevich told me that he had some success. By the start of 2023, the SBU learned to make its communication systems more resistant to outside interference. We hacked the positioning system on the Starlinks, Lukashevich said, so Musk will not be able to shut them off whenever he wants. The Ukrainians also experimented with other communication systems for their drones, including wireless mesh networks, which use radio nodes to relay frequencies across a broad segment of the war zone. But nothing came close to the effectiveness of Starlink, which remained a central pillar of Ukraine's defenses and a source of deep concern for its leadership. Throughout the war, military and political leaders have consistently told me they could never be sure whether Musk would intervene again to block one of their riskier operations and what his motives might be. These concerns grew acute in August of 2024 when Ukraine launched its first offensive across the border into Russia, seizing a large chunk of territory in the region of Kursk. Military commanders found that their Starlink terminals stopped working as soon as they entered that region. Starlink set the limit at the border of Ukraine, Colonel Pavlo Yelizarov, commander of one of Ukraine's most effective drone units, Lazar's group, whose bombers are controlled through Starlink, told me. So we have to find some other solutions. The issue came up again a year ago when Trump returned to the White House. His initial attempts to force a swift end of the war led to tensions with Zelensky, who refused to accept a peace proposal with terms that favored the Russians. Last February, Reuters reported that one of Trump's envoys had tried to pressure the Ukrainians by threatening to cut off their access to Starlink. The tensions culminated the following week during a televised clash between Trump and Zelensky in the Oval Office. After that, the United States paused all aid to Ukraine for about a week. Without access to intelligence from U.S. spy agencies, Ukraine's offensive in the Kursk region faltered, and its troops were soon forced to pull back. Zelensky did not blame the Americans for that reversal. In an interview last March, a couple of weeks after the U.S. resumed sharing intelligence and supplying other military aid, he declined to say whether Trump's envoys had threatened to block Starlink access. There were these reports that Starlink could be turned off, but I don't know how true that was, Zelensky told me. Even the possibility of such a threat, he added, has certainly pushed us to look for alternatives, and we have been doing that. But Ukraine has not yet found a system that works nearly as well as Starlink. Any attempt to shut it off, Zelensky said, would be very sensitive for us. I asked him to be more specific. How sensitive, exactly? The president stared at me for a long moment and drew out his words for emphasis. I think it would be very sensitive. The sensitivity came into focus this month when Musk intervened in the war once again. As part of Fedorov's plan to create a whitelist of Starlink users, SpaceX has restricted access to the system in Ukraine. By coincidence, I was due to embed that week on a mission with a Ukrainian drone unit, whose commander contacted me at the last minute with some worrying news. The unit's Starlink terminals had stopped working as normal. Whenever its drones flew faster than 80 kilometers per hour, their Starlink connection would cut off. The disruption had forced his unit and many others throughout the war zone to ground its drones until their Starlink terminals could be registered with SpaceX. We've already submitted everything, and we expect the limitation to be lifted, he told me on February 1st. Within a few days, the whitelist system was up and running, and the Starlinks approved for flight were back in operation across Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russian drone units were scrambling to find a way around the band. Their agents tried to bribe Ukrainians to register their Starlink terminals to comply with the whitelist. Earlier this month, a Ukrainian couple living in the region of Odessa were arrested for agreeing to register a Starlink for the Russians in exchange for $30, according to the SBU, which said in a statement that the couple faced life imprisonment if convicted. In a separate case, Ukrainian cyber operatives created a fake Starlink registration system and invited Russian soldiers to use it for a fee. The scam reportedly tricked Russian drone operators into giving away the location of their Starlink terminals, allowing Ukrainian artillery and drones to target them. For the moment, Ukraine seems to have the upper hand against the Russians, at least when it comes to battlefield communications. Fedorov, the defense minister, has publicly expressed his gratitude to Musk for giving Ukraine that advantage, and Musk has pledged to continue his support. Looks like the steps we took to stop the unauthorized use of Starlink by Russia have worked, Musk wrote. Let us know if more needs to be done. Our second story, how America chose not to hold the powerful to account. This is written by Adam Serwer. Around the world, powerful men are facing consequences for their actions. Former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro was convicted of trying to overthrow the government in a January 6-style coup, as was his South Korean counterpart, Yoon Suk-yeol. Marcin Romanowski, the former deputy justice minister in the right-wing Polish government, is in hiding in Hungary, accused of misusing public funds. The former Prince Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, became the first member of the British royal family in several centuries to be arrested. He's been accused of crimes related to his relationship with the late sex trafficking financier Jeffrey Epstein. They're all unfortunate not to be American. Otherwise, they probably would have gotten away scot-free. One way to look at the rise of Donald Trump is as part of a decades-long backlash among the American leadership class to the idea of accountability. Since Richard Nixon was forced to resign, powerful people in both political parties have worked assiduously to ensure that their leaders would escape the consequences of their actions. Trump has evaded punishment for crimes both low and high. This is not just about Trump. His impunity is the product of a society that has worked hard to help the rich and powerful elude punishment for criminal behavior. Gerald Ford pardoned his predecessor in the name of healing, but inadvertently set a precedent that executive lawbreaking was no crime. The Reagan administration engaged in blatant violations of federal law during the Iran-Contra scandal, in which it sold weapons to the Iranian regime and used its finances to support anti-communist death squads in Nicaragua. George H.W. Bush, the former head of the CIA, pardoned nearly all of the officials implicated in Iran-Contra, a move that many Americans supported because they believed that fighting communism justified extreme measures. Bill Clinton lied under oath, was impeached, and then acquitted, and many Americans supported that too because they sympathized with lying about infidelity. After that, Congress decided in bipartisan fashion that it had enough of special counsels sniffing around the executive branch. Barack Obama pledged to look forward and not backward, not only closing the door on prosecutions for executive lawbreaking, but also failing to hold accountable those responsible for the 2008 financial crisis and the ensuing Great Recession. While Congress and the presidency have been working hard to raise the executive branch above the law, the Supreme Court has done its part to ensure that laws against bribery and corruption are near unenforceable. With a series of rulings on campaign finance, the Roberts Court has ensured that the rich can try to buy elections without formally breaking the law. As a result, politicians are indebted to a few hundred billionaires who drop unholy amounts of cash every election cycle. Getting convicted of bribery in America requires some serious effort. Take former Democratic Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, who was convicted of selling influence on behalf of local businesses and the country of Egypt after being caught with gold bars in his house. When Trump first took office, he paused enforcement of foreign bribery cases entirely, but there are some signs that he intends to revive such prosecutions as a weapon against his political enemies, in the mold of Hungarian strongman Viktor Orban. Such erosion of anti-corruption law has often been a bipartisan project. In 2016, the bribery conviction of former Virginia Governor Bob McDowell for receiving gifts Bob McDonnell, for receiving gifts from donors, was overturned unanimously by the U.S. Supreme Court. Since then, the Roberts Court has slowly dismantled anti-corruption law. The logic of the Roberts Court's quest to legalize white-collar crime led to Trump versus the United States, which decided in 2024 that the president is basically entitled to commit whatever crimes he wants in the course of his official duties, which successfully shields Trump and potentially future presidents from federal criminal prosecution for any official actions while in office. Although some of the decisions were more defensible than others, together they suggest a pattern of elite class solidarity. Powerful people making sure that powerful people rarely face real consequences. The Me Too and Black Lives Matters movements can be seen as, at least partially, a brief rebellion against this culture of elite impunity. Left with few formal avenues for redress, large numbers of people demanded that the powerful, bosses and celebrities who used their status to coerce others into sexual relationships, or police officers who had used their authority to kill without consequence, be made to pay a price for hurting others. These movements didn't last. The backlash against them nevertheless fed a Trumpian nostalgia for the good old days when sexual assault and police brutality were easily rationalized, if not even discussed. This is not to say that the rich and powerful are never held to account. Menendez is one counterexample, and Epstein himself was a billionaire who died in a jail cell, after all. But his crimes were taken seriously by authorities only after a journalist, Julie Brown, uncovered the extent of Epstein's crimes and the lenient response from law enforcement over the decades. Unfortunately, many Americans who might have been outraged at this edifice of impunity have instead directed their resentment toward the poor and weak, supporting a cruel and unforgiving system of criminal justice that harshly punishes those at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder while exempting many at the top from any accountability at all. So you did a few death squad massacres or wedding bombings? Well, that's what America's leaders had to do to fight communism and terrorism. You can even take a sack of cash from an undercover FBI agent if you're the Trump immigration czar Tom Homan. But if you overstayed your visa or got an abortion, you deserve to have the book thrown at you. Trump himself can be seen as benefiting from a backlash against accountability in the last place powerful people in America seem to face it, the court of public opinion. MAGA offered an implicit bargain. Not only can you be a bigot toward whatever group makes you mad by existing, but everyone will have to love and respect you anyway. This was an impossible promise to keep. Not even Trump has managed to bully comedians mocking him into silence. But politicians make impossible promises all the time. Many Americans are simply content to live vicariously through Trump's impunity, even if they cannot share it. I don't want to overstate the case that America is unique in its embrace of elite impunity. Brazil and South Korea are arguably outliers in their commitment to defending the integrity of their democracy against the corruption of the wealthy and powerful. But they also don't hold themselves out as an indispensable nation, the shining city on the hill, the model to which all other democracies should aspire. The answer to why powerful people in some other parts of the world face consequences, while in America they rarely do, is that elite impunity is now an American national project. We might need to reframe American exceptionalism. Instead of a New Deal, we have a great society for white-collar crime, a new frontier of executive lawbreaking, a no rich crook left behind. Most of us probably don't even realize it. Nevertheless, this has been the priority for the wealthy and powerful, who have managed to convince a critical mass of Americans that they will be able to enjoy the same privileges. They won't. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us the next time. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.